to the right. Rocky tracked it with a jaunty tilt of his rapidly beating wings. The fields below them were changing from long, narrow strips that hugged the undulating ground west of the Moravan to large squares and rectangles on the comparatively flat lands east of it. Some fields were green with sprouting wheat, oats or barley. Others showed rich, newly turned dark earth, waiting to be sown with flax and peas and beans. "I guess farms are larger, closer to Brendinus," said Aenon. Nerd nodded.
"Some of that is the Duke of Tyford's land," said the big man. "The Duchess of Whitrose has her holdings up ahead, and the Duke of Bludow's estates are south of hers, according to a book full of maps I studied in Damon's library. They need big estates to support all the knights they owe the crown."
His baron, back in Caer Cadel, in the southern part of the Coombe, only had a dozen knights, Aenon considered, though they did drink a lot. It probably took quite a bit of barley to keep them in beer.
"How many dukes and duchesses are there?" Aenon asked.
12, answered Nerd, "plus 24 earls or countesses, and who knows how many barons."
"That's a lot of nobles," said Aenon.
"Durin is a big kingdom," Nerd replied.
"We hardly ever see nobles in the Coombe."
"From what Damon's told me, you should count yourself lucky on that score. The greater the noble, the greater the ego, he says."
"Is that going to be in his next volume of epigrams?" asked Aenon.
"If I remind him to write it down," said Nerd. "But I don't plan to continue being Master Mage Elderman's servant any longer."
Aenon was pleased to hear the certainty in Nerd's voice. "Nerd should have had his wander year 5 or 6 years ago," Aenon guessed. Maybe his friend would take time to travel before deciding what he wanted to do next. Aenon calculated that Rocky was flying high enough to look more like a large hawk from the ground than a wyvern. He could barely make out men and women below him as tiny figures herding cattle and tending fields. Very few looked up. There were more people in the lands they were flying over than back in the Coombe, however. They must have flown over 100 villages and a dozen fortified manor houses. Aenon had seen 3 sizable castles along their path and thought he'd seen another off to the northeast. They seemed at least as big as the Earl's Fortress at Ruthro Keep. The weather was changing too. The sun was still shining, but additional clouds were clustering in the sky around them, more densely packed above like the villages below. Rocky descended slightly to stay beneath them, following Aenon's tasty ball of solidified sand.
"Do you think it's much farther to the Brenhaven?" asked Aenon, straining to look ahead.
"Not much farther at all," said Nud. "I can see it in the distance. We're almost there."
"Where?" asked Aenon. He remembered the far-seeing spell he'd used when they were collecting gold earlier, and called on his blue magestone to generate the appropriate lenses.
"There," said Nud, pointing to the right. "There are hundreds of dragon ships on the water. I can see their sails."
Aenon guided Rocky in a slow turn to the right so he could see what Nud had seen. Ships with colourful square sails and pointed prows and sterns filled the Brenhaven from bank to bank. With his magically aided vision, Aenon could see round shields along the sides of the ships and oars moving rhythmically, moving the vessels upriver. The largest dragon ship was 3 ranks back. It had a white sail with a wide gold stripe down the centre, and some sort of animal, a beaver, Aenon realised, painted in black on the stripe. A crown was outlined in black above the beaver. "That must be King Bajani's ship," thought Aenon. He yawned, which made sense given how little sleep he'd had the previous night, and tried to put thoughts of Merry and the Conclave aside while he focused on the negotiations ahead, hoping Nud would take the lead in dealing with the King of the Bifalanders. Then any hope of gaining focus shattered, like ice sliding off a slate roof onto cobblestones. A dozen gold blurs descended from the clouds above them, some slapping at Rocky, Nerd and Aenon with pointed tails. Others were snapping at them with heads filled with sharp teeth on the ends of long necks. Chi leapt down and landed on Einan's head, distracting him and slowing his response to the attack. The Raconet crawled around so his belly was in Einan's face and held onto Einan's ears with his tiny claws digging into unprotected flesh. Rocky twisted and turned, trying to escape his tormentors without success. There were too many of them, and they wheeled about in intricate attack patterns, bumping the wyvern's head, neck and wings with their bodies.
Einan and Nud had to concentrate on hanging onto the scarf tied to bony protrusions on Rocky's upper back. They were hanging upside down more than once, 1,000 feet in the air, before the wyvern rotated back to his usual orientation for flight. There were lots of screams causing pain for the inside of Einan's ears, like cheese claws were hurting their exteriors. Einan knew he wasn't screaming. Cheese belly fur covered his nose and mouth so he could barely breathe. Rocky was trumpeting his distress with a deep basso bugle. But the screams were high-pitched, like a horde of children playing tag on the village square and haywall. Einan could feel more bumps as something or a group of somethings smacked against Rocky's sides behind him. Rocky rose, suddenly lighter, and Einan managed to push Chi around so the raconette was clutching the back of his head, not the front. Thus liberated, Einan leaned up and tried to determine exactly who or what was attacking him. He saw a dozen small, gold-scaled dragons, each the size of a wizened, wheeling up and away back into the clouds above him. They were carrying riders with long yellow braids who seemed to be children, not fully grown. That explains the high-pitched screaming, thought Einan. And they had the pillowcases filled with gold. Blast! Einan turned to his friend to see why the big man had been uncharacteristically quiet during the attack, but didn't see him. Nod was gone. Chapter 17. Merry.
"Why don't we ask him ourselves?" asked Queen Caris.
She frowned and looked at the ceiling for a moment. Her tone had shifted from comfortable great-grandmother to unhappy sovereign. Astri said nothing, and seemed to retreat into a hood she was no longer wearing.
"Daemon left Brendinas 40 years ago, and hasn't returned," continued the Queen. "He won't even talk to Fircher, and she's his favourite student," said Astri, finding her voice. "They can't stand to be in the same room together, and haven't spoken in 2 decades.
"What happened?" asked Merry.
"Fircher made choices Daemon disagreed with," said Queen Carius. "She followed her own path and stumbled on the way. Daemon never let her forget it."
"Aren't apprentices supposed to become masters and seek their own course?" asked Merry. "They make their own mistakes and learn from them. That is the natural order of things, isn't it?"
"Their particular situation was more complex," said Astri, "and they could both teach stubborn to a bull wizened."
Merry smiled.
"I've only been Fircher's apprentice for a short while, but that was obvious from the start. Daemon seems to be cut from the same cloth."
"They were like 2 flathorns clashing antlers," said Astri.
Her eyes were unfocused, staring at a distant corner of the room, like her thoughts were drifting back to somewhere long ago and far away.
"Flathorns?" asked Merry.
"Big deer from Melyn Carrick," said Astri. "Like stags, as big as oxen, with huge, flat antlers."
"That helps explain something about the gate in the pool at the bottom of Fircher's Tower," said Merry. "I remember her saying, 'I'm not going back through that gate if the legions of the Eagle People and the Royal Army of Tamlock are on my doorstep.'"
"I can imagine Fircher saying those very words," said Queen Caris.
"I've heard her say them," said Astri. "She set up that gate outside the castle so she could send things to her son."
"Without Daemon interfering," whispered the Queen.
"The tall, dark-haired man with the crossbow?" asked Merry.
"I expect so. Nod favours that weapon," said Astri.
"Where did you see him?"
"He was with Daemon at the quarry when we fought the Tamlock wizards and soldiers. The last I saw him, he was behind a quarryman's wagon, shooting back at Tamlock archers."
"That sounds like Nod," said the Queen.
"He gave it away when he called Fircher mother," said Merry. "And rightly so," said Astri, "since she is his mother."
"He was one of Fircher's stumbles that Daemon was afraid might happen," said the Queen, leaning forward in her chair.
"Nod seems like quite a nice man, whatever his origins," said Merry. "He was very brave at the quarry."
"That's good to hear," said Astri. "He is a nice young man, even if he has spent too much of his life in Melyn Carrick."
Merry was concerned for Einan. He'd tried to contact her 4 times using Dothan's magic ring. She wanted to end this interrogation by 2 old women who seemed to know when every squirrel dropped a nut in the royal forest along the Ruthro. Enough was enough, even if one of the Inquisitors was the Dowager Queen of Darren. Merry had conducted enough subtle questioning sessions of her own to know when one had reached a point of diminishing returns. She hadn't spent enough time travelling with Daemon to have more information to give Caris and Astri.
"It's been a pleasure to meet you both," said Merry, "but I really need to get back to the antechamber outside the King's study so I can wait for Daemon. Perhaps I'll learn more from him, something the two of you don't know already."
Merry stood, smiled, and performed another bow and curtsy.
"I told you she was her father's daughter," said Queen Caris.
Astri stood as well.
"Help me on with my robes and hood before you leave, please."
Merry assisted the older wizard and adjusted the folds of her robes so they draped properly. Astri's face disappeared under her hood again. Someone rapped sharply on the door to the chamber.
"Did you summon a servant?"
Astri asked Caris.
"No," said the queen. "I thought you'd show Merry back."
Astri fashioned a thick protective bubble of solidified sound around Queen Caris by adjusting and strengthening the privacy bubble she'd put in place earlier. Once that defensive measure was complete, Astri stepped past Merry to the door.
"Who is there?" she asked. "Open up, or I'll have it knocked down,"
said a voice that might have been pretty if it didn't honk out each syllable like an irritated goose.
"Oh, her," said Queen Caris.
"I'm afraid so," said Astri.
"Guard your tongue, dear," said the queen to Merry, "and count your fingers if you shake her hand. Don't eat or drink anything she offers you."
"Yes, your majesty," said Merry.
"Go ahead, open it," said Caris.
Astri removed the wards and pulled the door open. A woman of medium height, with raven hair done up in a tower above her head and wrapped with strings of pearls, was standing in the doorway. She wore a low-cut, sky-blue satin gown with white vertical stripes under a dark blue, ermine-trimmed velvet surcoat adorned with pearl buttons. A silver coronet, made from twisted wire in knotwork patterns with sparkling diamonds, perched above her forehead at the base of the tower of hair. Her nose was sharp, and her face was powdered and rouged to such a degree that she looked like a garish child's doll, not the mother of a king. The woman's face darkened like a thundercloud until she glanced beyond Astri and spotted Merry.
"There you are," said the woman. "I'm Princess Gwynedd, King Dario's mother. You may have heard of me."
Merry nodded, impressed by the ensemble, if not by the princess.
"Of course you have," said Princess Gwynedd. "Leave these old women to their naps and join me in my apartments. We have so much to talk about."
That said, the princess took Merry's arm and bustled her out the door. Chapter 18. Daemon.
"Freezing the Brenhaven."
Daemon sat back in his chair, stroked his chin and stared at the young king.
"How did you manage to fool so many people into thinking you were an idiot?"
"It wasn't hard."
Daemon laughed, spraying a mouthful of watered wine. He wiped his mouth with the back of his hand.
"My mother helped," Dario continued.
He leaned against the corner of his writing desk, closest to Daemon, sighed and crossed his long legs.
"She's in on your subterfuge."
"Not at all," said Dario.
"My vain, venal and manipulative mother has been telling everyone in court she's the real ruler of Darren ever since my father and great-grandfather died 2 years ago. He refilled Daemon's goblet from the pitcher on his sideboard. "She's the one spreading stories about my capricious moods and poor judgment. I just decided to play the part she chose for me. I'd hoped it would entice Tamlok into attacking us sooner rather than later, since they can't train new wizards easily."
"Since the mines in the Green Mountains played out," said Daemon, half to himself. "I sense the delicate touch of Queen Caris at work."
Dario smiled back, revealing nothing and everything.
"Your hope was well-founded, it seems," said Daemon. "Tamlok does appear ready to attack us."
If sending 500 dragon ships to sack Brendina's counts as an attack, said Dario.
It would for most kings, said Daemon.
The two men grinned.
I'll need a map of the river, said Daemon.
Which I happen to have on my desk, said Dario, retrieving a parchment from behind him. The young king and the master mage held the map in front of them, considering options for stopping the Bifalanders, like two old friends deciding where to travel for a holiday.
Chapter 19. Furcher and Dothan.
Now what?
Asked Dothan, as he and Furcher stood to one side of the legions and watched the first ranks of soldiers march through the gate to Darren. A privacy sphere shimmered around them. Furcher was lost in thought, half hypnotized by the rhythm of the legionnaires' measured paces. Dothan touched her arm. Is it time to go back to Brendina's? I'm concerned the Conclave's infighting will get out of hand without adult supervision.
You're taking your role as nominal head of the Conclave far too seriously, said Furcher, pulling herself away from wherever her mind had wandered. Remember, you're not herding house cats. You're trying to keep a squawk of angry griffins from following their nature.
So I shouldn't try to lead the Conclave?
I didn't say that. Someone has to keep them in line, and you're elected, but you shouldn't get your hopes up for civilized behavior.
I harbour no illusions, said Dothan. The members of the Conclave often elect the person to lead them that most of them think they can browbeat.
Though not in your case. You were selected because the various factions saw you as a potentially fair referee.
Won't they be surprised, said Dothan.
His face looked like he'd bitten into a particularly sour persimmon.
Maybe it is best if you return directly to the capital, said Furcher.
And where will you be going?
Rias. You can't leave me to cope with the machinations of the Conclave on my own, protested Dothan. I need you to hold them down while I beat them with a club.
I'm sure you'll manage without me, said Furcher.
Or be managed, said Dothan.
I was counting on your vote and your unique approach to diplomatic persuasion. Threaten a fellow wizard with immolation once and you never live it down.
It was hardly just a threat. You burned off half his beard.
The randy goat deserved it, said Furcher. He's lucky I didn't burn off the hair somewhere else.
As I said, your unique approach.
Taxing hedge wizards for healings, charms and potions was one of the most ludicrous ideas I'd ever heard.
Most of our colleagues agreed with you, said Dothan, and now many of them fear you, or fear crossing you anyway.
I like to think I command their respect.
You do, said Dothan. And that makes us a good team. I'll need your help when it comes to getting the others to follow their assignments in the war effort.
I understand, said Furcher, and I'll try to get back as fast as I can. Princess Gwynedd's faction will be hard to handle even with me around to knock heads, metaphorically, of course.
Of course, said Dothan. Say hello to Vero for me.
What makes you think I'm going to Rias to see...
Dothan smiled at her.
Right. I am that transparent, said Furcher. Maybe if I can talk to him, I can diffuse tensions and get this war called off before the first blows are struck.
Ha! Said Dothan. It's more likely you'll be taken prisoner, leaving me at the mercy of Gwynedd's faction.
The princess is not one of your favourite people, said Furcher.
It was a statement with no hint of a question.
Has she done something particular to earn your ire of late?
Other than trying to slip potions of compliance into Dario's meals, you mean?
Hasn't she been doing that for the past 2 years?
Yes, but now she's trying to get him to marry her sister's daughter.
His first cousin? Just to keep power in her family?
Dothan nodded, then slowly shook his head from side to side.
There's more? Asked Furcher.
I don't think anything that woman does would surprise me. She's capable of anything.
True, said Dothan. Since you're going north to talk to Vero, I should tell you the rest of it.
Furcher glanced around and saw Mafuta and Felix near the gate ensuring its integrity. She made the sphere of solidified sound protecting their privacy opaque as well as soundproof.
Tell me, said Furcher. It might give me some leverage.
Dothan laughed. It will at that, he said. Do you remember when Derry had to move from his estates in the east to the Rothero Valley?
Of course. That was the same time you came west as well and built your tower. 18 or 19 years ago. Did you ever wonder why we left Brendinas? The story for public consumption at the time was that you wanted to get away from court and conclave politics, said Fircher, though the gossip around the palace was that the two of you had royally ticked off Princess Gwynedd for some unknown reason. I was young and naive enough at the time to believe the first version.
The gossip was more accurate, said Dothan. As a soldier, Derry had ceremonial duties in the palace along with tending his estates. By chance, he was assigned to guard the princess while her husband, Prince Dari, was on a hunting trip to the mountains.
Dothan paused.
Go on, urged Fircher,
glad they couldn't be seen by anyone around them.
Derry heard interesting sounds from inside the royal chambers and contacted me using a ring I'd given him. I was close at hand in the palace library and came immediately.
Who was her lover? Asked Fircher. A groom? A noble?
A prince, Dothan answered. Derry wanted to make sure the princess wasn't being taken against her will, though I am told it certainly didn't sound like it. We made our way to the servants' entrance to her chambers by side corridors. I unlocked the service door with magic. We entered, stood behind a curtain, and peered around it. Derry and I saw enough to identify the man. Fircher had a pained expression.
Tell me, she said. Was it Vero?
No, said Dothan. Vero wasn't in court.
Then who?
Fircher demanded. King Tuathal. Well, then, Prince Tuathal. You were there when the royal delegations from Tamlock first came to Brendinas.
I was, said Fircher. I have a permanent reminder of that visit.
This was their second, after Dari had married Gwynedd. Don't you remember how the princess flirted with Tuathal?
I'd left court by then, shortly after the first visit from Tamlock royalty, if you'll recall, said Fircher. I was in Melyn Carrick, coping with an energetic 3-year-old by the time of their second visit. I only heard about Gwynedd flirting with Tuathal second-hand.
That's right, said Dothan. I forgot. You left and got as far away from Brendinas as you could manage.
With good reason, said Fircher. Court is no place to raise a child.
As young Dario knows all too well, said Dothan. Have you told Vero about Nud?
No, and I don't plan to, said Fircher. It's bad enough you know. I shouldn't have told you all those years ago.
My lips are sealed, said Dothan, cutting her off.
Thank you, said Fircher,
clasping her hands in front of her chest and bowing slightly.
What happened afterward?
All I know is you and Derry were my new neighbours shortly after I moved from Melyn Carrick to the Ruthera Valley. My friends at court and conclave didn't have much to tell me, and the two of you weren't talking.
What do you think happened?
We told Queen Caris, and she advised us it was best to get as far away from Brendinas as we could manage. She arranged for a new barony for Derry, and funds to help me build my tower close by upriver.
Now it all makes sense, said Fircher.
And Prince Dario arrived on the scene 9 months later.
Exactly, said Dothan.
I confirmed it with a consanguinity spell when he was born.
You always were interested in hedge wizard magic.
It helped me play the part while in exile.
Why did you come back to Brendinas and take such a public role on the conclave, then? Asked Fircher. Wouldn't it be wiser to stay out of sight in the west?
That was the old queen's idea, said Dothan. Having me around reminds Gwynedd that Caris has something on her.
Thank goodness Queen Caris is keeping her hand in, said Fircher. I'm much happier being part of her faction than the alternative.
Supporting the princess isn't an option, said Dothan. I'd go into permanent exile before serving Gwynedd.
Now you're sounding like Daemon.
He was motivated by love. My motivation would be the opposite.
Fircher inclined her chin and brought it back up. She returned to the same unfocused, half-hypnotized look she'd had earlier. After a few seconds, her face changed and her eyes lit up with newfound knowledge. Dario's not the rightful king, she said.
You have been paying attention.
And that means, Fircher began.
That can wait until later, Dothan interrupted. Go to Rias. Find Vero. See if you can talk him and King Tuathel out of this war, which I doubt, and get back here as soon as you can.
Right, said Fercher.
The opaque bubble around them faded like dew on a summer day. Fercher confirmed her flying disc was still on her back. She inserted herself into a space between ranks of legionnaires marching through the gate and was on the other side in a heartbeat. Dothan waved at her, but she was already on her disc flying north toward a gate to Rias, somewhere in Brendinas. He fiddled with a ring on his left little finger and had a brief but productive conversation with a friend and ally. Intira would get the word out to Daran's crown and free wizards to assemble. Reluctantly, after waving to Mafuta and Felix, Dothan waited for a gap between cohorts and trudged through the gate's interface. It was time to return to the capital and cope with the conclave. Chapter 20. Nud and Einan.
Nud? Said Einan, then repeated it louder. Nud!
There was no response. Nud's end of the extra-long scarf they'd used to anchor themselves to Rocky's broad back was flapping in the wind. Einan hoped his friend hadn't been trying to get out his crossbow to fight off their attackers and untied the scarf around himself in the process. He leaned to the right, Nud's side, as far as he could without untying his own end of the scarf, but couldn't see anything except a long way down to a stretch of brown fields. There wasn't even a convenient lake, river or stream Nud might have landed in, though Einan realized after a moment that any such body of water would have been at least a mile behind them. Chi was only a step away from pure panic. The raconette was still on top of Einan's head, using Einan's ears like the handles on a heavy cast-iron pan. Rocky was flying straight and level, continuing their previous course, even without the tasty ball of solidified sound Einan used to guide him. The wyvern's head was moving back and forth like a bat snake considering a mouse, scanning the fluffy white clouds above for signs of the small gold dragons who'd attacked them. Chortles of high-pitched laughter came from inside the nearest cloud.
Those murdering dragon-riding thieves were still close by, thought Einan.
His red magestone pulsed and glowed. Einan felt blood rush to his face and sensed his heart pounding in anger now, not fear.
They killed my friend and stole the gold we'd collected to save Daran from the Biffalad invaders. It's time to teach them the folly of attacking a wizard.
Einan reached up and slowly removed Chi's claws from his ears. He stroked Chi's fur to calm him, then lifted the little beast over his head and tucked him into a hollow at the base of Rocky's neck. The raconette wrapped both his small arms around the nearest bony projection and held on, reflexively stuttering out a nervous,
Chee, 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 chee.
Einan rubbed Chi's velvet-like fur, then reached over his head again and felt the reassuring smoothness of his flying disc on top of his pack. He tugged at it, and the disc came free. Einan held it tight in one hand while untying the knot in the scarf holding him in place with the other. When he was no longer tethered to Rocky's back, he generated a plane of solidified sound above him, the same color as the wyvern's hide, to disguise his movements, shifted his chest until it rested on top of his flying disc, and ascended to enter the clouds. It wasn't easy to see inside the nearest cloud. Drops of water coated his body and ran down the back of his neck. Einan took a deep breath to help him think, and realized he didn't have to put up with that sort of annoyance. He was a wizard. He generated a thin wall of solidified sound close to his skin to keep the moisture away, and used a tiny fraction of the heat his red magestone could channel to dry himself off.
Now, if I can only figure out how to see, Einan considered.
He remembered the lenses that helped him get a closer view of things far away, and called on the stored wisdom of his blue magestone to craft a set of them. They didn't help. Vision inside the cloud was so constrained that far away and close at hand were much the same. Einan wondered what it would take to see inside a cloud, and suddenly he could. Everything around him was indistinct and had a red tinge, but he could make out 12 dragons flying ahead of him with 12 small human forms on their backs. Einan said a silent thank you inside his head to both his mage stones. He didn't know which one had responded to his thoughts, but he was pleased with the results. Now he could do something. Einan moved a few feet up and got closer to the dragons.
He could hear their riders talking and laughing.
"Did you see that boy's head, Sigrun?" asked one. "Was that a baby raccoon?" "Or some other strange southern animal," replied a voice Einan assumed belonged to Sigrun.
"Maybe it was a monkey," said a third rider. "My uncle saw one when he went across the ocean."
"No one cares about your uncle and a monkey on the other side of the world, Randvager," said a slightly deeper voice.
"Ha ha ha, Holgir, you're a monkey," said Randvager.
"I'm not,"
said the slightly deeper voice that must be Holgir.
"The dark-haired one was cute," said another girl.
"Good thing you caught him," said Sigrun.
"It's a long way down," said the first voice.
Nud was alive. Where was he? The new lenses somehow showed living creatures fairly clearly. They glowed, even through the hats and furs the riders were wearing. Nud's large body wasn't on the back of any of the dragons. Where was his friend? Einan's anger began to grow again. Then he realized the dragon riders were girls and boys, younger than his little sister. He reined in his emotions, given that Nud hadn't fallen to his death. He didn't know if the attack had been serious or sport, but either way, he wanted to find his friend, recover the gold, and be on his way. If he could teach the young dragon riders a lesson in the process, so much the better. Drawing on the power of his red mage stone, Einan warmed the air around him, like a small sun burning inside a whitewashed room. Seconds later, the clouds surrounding him and the dragon riders had evaporated. His special lenses, no longer needed, were gone as well. The dragon riders, most with long blonde braids and conical leather hats, turned their mounts to see what had vaporized their hiding place. Einan stood tall on his flying disc and expanded the protective shell around his body a few inches, turning its color red-gold. He used more energy from his red mage stone to generate crackling flames around him and shaped a transparent cone of solidified sound in front of his mouth to amplify his voice.
"Land at once or be immolated," he said,
trying to make his voice sound deep and menacing. It cracked twice and only ended up being deep, but he'd gained the dragon rider's attention. He made the flames around him burn brighter to reinforce his message.
"Thunder and lightning," one rider exclaimed. "What does immolated mean?" asked another. "Burned alive," said Sigrun. "We'd better do what that thing says."
One of the riders on the far side of the wing of dragons tried to run for it, but Einan stopped her with a small fireball a few feet ahead of her mount's nose. He pointed to a broad limestone outcrop near a square of well-tended woodlands on the edge of an estate below. The riders descended. Einan saw Rocky hovering close by and created a red sphere of particularly tasty solidified sound to guide the wyvern down as well. He saw that Rocky carried something in his claws. It was Nud.
"Thank goodness," thought Einan.
Rocky landed on one side of the flat expanse of rock, gently placing Nud on a bed of green moss. All 12 of the dragon riders touched down on the other side, their eyes tracking Einan floating a few feet above them.
"Dismount," Einan commanded.
The riders reluctantly climbed down from their dragons and stood by their arrowhead-shaped heads, helping them stay calm. Their dragon's gold scales flashed in the afternoon sunlight and shimmered red where they reflected Einan's fiery, designated to intimidate form. He noticed that the riders, 10 girls and 2 boys from what he could tell, all carried knives and axes on their belts. A short boy had a one-handed crossbow, and a tall girl had a short sword with twin gold dragon heads as its hilt.
"Disarm!"
Einan burned a circle the diameter of his flying disc into the rock, 20 paces in front of the riders. Each one in turn stepped forward, removed their weapons, and put them in the dark circle. The tall girl with the short sword was the last to approach. She tossed her knife and hand axe into the circle, but didn't move to unbuckle her sword belt.
"Do what he says, Sigrun," urged one of the girls. "You don't want him to burn you."
"My parents gave me this sword," said Sigrun over her shoulder.
She looked at Einan defiantly.
"Turn me to your ash if you want, but you can't have it. Your sword is of no importance."
Einan was making things up as he went along, but was used to dealing with stubborn people. Sigrun continued to stand her ground.
"You can reclaim it when you've returned my gold." "There's gold in those bags?" asked a girl. "We're rich," said another.
"We're dead if we try to keep it," said Holgir,
the boy with the crossbow. Sigrun was still standing in front of the circle, burnt into the rock.
She stared up at Einan. He saw she wore two large gold brooches, pinning an embroidered apron of fine white fabric to her bright yellow shirt.
"Those bags are ours by right of plunder," said Sigrun. "Any gold they have belongs to us now."
Einan admired the girl's courage, if not her wisdom. He thought about telling her he was plundering it back, but tried another approach.
"That gold is meant for the king of the Bifalanders, not for you."
His statement didn't prompt the reaction he expected. Instead of showing fear, Sigrun laughed. So did the other dragon riders behind her. Even their dragons snorted.
"What?"
said Einan, too surprised to continue his act.
"King Bajani is my father," said Sigrun. "If you're taking it to him, we'll help you load it back in your wyvern and see to your companion. We'll even escort you to the fleet."
"He's the cute one,"
said the girl with the longest braids. Said Einan, his flying disc slowly descending without him consciously directing it to do so. The cone in front of his lips faded away.
"Come on, team," said Sigrun, waving to her companions. "Grab your weapons and start carrying bags."
Einan touched down and dropped his flaming facade. He was eager to check on Nud.
"The skinny one isn't much older than we are," said a girl. "He's still a wizard," said Sigrun. "Treat him with respect, even if he did try to scare us to death." "I can still throw fireballs," said Einan, but any hint of menace had left his voice. "Can you help me see to my friend?"
"Bring your healer's kit, Ranvegir," said Sigrun.
She retrieved her knife and axe and looked Einan up and down like a judge trying to tell if he was lying about who owned a pig. Ranvegir and Sigrun walked past Einan, heading for the bed of moss near Rocky, where Nud had been placed. Einan followed them, wondering who was being taught a lesson. He saw Chi sitting on the moss near Nud's head, stroking his hair.
"When we've finished moving the gold, can we have lunch?" asked the boy who wasn't Holgir.
"Lunch would be good," said Nud, leaning up on one elbow. "I don't know where I am, but I'm hungry enough to eat a wizened."
Chapter 21. Merry.
"You look so much like your father," said Princess Gwynedd,
when she and Merry were seated in a not-so-cosy corner in the princess's suite. Gwynedd had contrived to have her chair look like a throne, 6 inches taller than the ones around it. Merry's chair had wide arms and a broad seat. It was so thickly padded that Merry felt like she'd rolled onto the centre of an old feather bed and faded into its folds. She perched on the edge of her seat to avoid disappearing entirely. Merry smiled and nodded. She expected she'd be doing a lot of that during her conversation with the princess.
"I had a crush on him when I first came to the palace," said Gwynedd. "He was a dashing young man then, one of the heroes of the battle at the gates of Nova Eberacum. My late husband, Prince Dari, was a hero too, you know, but he wasn't skilled at polite conversation."
"Smile and nod. Don't eat or drink anything. Count your fingers."
"Your father was more than just a soldier," the princess continued. "He read books and was friends with that wizard. What was his name?"
"Dothan?" said Merry.
"Yes, that's it," said the princess. "Though he went by Landothan then. A nosy fellow, always getting to other people's business. Would you like some tea, dear?"
She gestured toward a pot on the table in front of them with two finely made cups beside it.
"No, thank you," said Merry.
"As you wish," sniffed Gwynedd.
"But you're missing out on a treat. It's delicious."
Smile and nod.
"Anyway, I don't see why he had to come back to Brendinas after all this time. It's rude, that's what it is. He should have stayed away far to the west and kept making fertility potions and healing farmers' broken legs."
"Keep my mask up. Don't let her see how much I want to respond. She knows much more about Dothan than she wants me to think."
"He should have stayed along the Ruthro, like your father," said Gwynedd. "Sir Derwin is a wise man, smart enough to leave court when it was sensible to do so, and wiser still to stay away."
Merry turned up her palms, smiled and nodded.
"You'll tell him that, won't you, next time you see him?"
Nod, then smile.
"Good," said Gwynedd. "I knew you'd understand. And if you see Landothan, give him the same message. I understand the two of you are quite close. What's he like, dear? You know, is it true what they say about wizards?"
Merry knew Princess Gwynnett was trying to provoke a reaction from her. The princess must have spies that told her Merry spent time in Dothan's tower when she made trips down the river to Tyford. It didn't matter if Gwynnett believed Merry was sleeping with Dothan, so long as the insinuation prompted Merry to say more than she should.
"I don't understand, Your Highness,"
Merry replied haltingly, like she was 10, not almost 16.
"What do you mean? People say lots of things about wizards. There are rumours about what they can do with solidified sound," said the princess. "Oh, yes," said Merry, pitching her voice to sound younger. "I've seen Dothan walk across the Rutho without getting his feet wet using circles of solidified sound."
Gwynnett smiled and nodded. Merry could sense the older woman's brain calculating more points to anchor her webs as she sought another approach for her interrogation. The princess lifted a plate off the table and presented it to Merry.
"Try one of the currant cakes, dear," she said. "They're quite tasty." "No, thank you," said Merry. "My brother used to tell me that currants were midges from the local marshes." "Blast," thought Merry. "I should have stopped at no thank you. And how is Solda doing in the north these days?"
"Caught," thought Merry. She couldn't prevent her mask from slipping for a moment and took an extra beat to say,
"How is my brother doing? He's not doing anything. He's dead." "Oh, dear. I'd forgotten. My condolences on your loss."
The princess looked as sorry as a fox in a henhouse with feathers caught in its fur. Merry lowered her head as if she was about to cry, but really to hide her face. She considered the fact that Gwynnett knew Solda was alive and probably knew he was in Rias.
Blast, she thought. Damon had a mole in his spy network, and that put her brother at risk. "Were you there when the Tamlock wizards invaded the Western Marches this morning?"
Everyone else seemed to know about the battle, so Merry didn't see any need to dissemble.
"Yes, I was at the quarry near the Coombe, where the Tamlock wizards came to dig for mage stones."
"And were they successful?" asked Gwynnett.
"Who?"
asked Merry.
"The invaders or the defenders?"
"The invaders, as you call them," said Gwynnett. "I'd have thought that was obvious from context."
"Forgive me, Your Highness. I was up early, and it's been a long day."
"Take your time, then," said Gwynnett.
"Do have some tea. It will wake you up."
Merry shook her head and went on.
"We drove the Tamlock forces away, but they did manage to collect several buckets of green mage stones."
"Did they?" asked Gwynnett.
"That's fascinating. Vero pulled it off."
The princess licked her lips and made Merry think of a cat who'd finished a bowl of cream. Merry tried to analyze Gwynnett's words. It seemed like she was less interested in Darren's success than Tamlock's. That made no sense. Her son was king of Daron. She'd have to share what she'd heard with Queen Caris and Astri and Damon to see if they could figure it out. It was time to leave and find them. The princess had continued to speak, and Merry's mind only now caught up to what her ears had heard.
"It's too dangerous for you to return to Applegarth or Upper Rathrow Keep," Gwynnett had said. "You should stay here in the palace with me, where you'll be safe."
Did Gwynnett really intend to hold her prisoner?
"I appreciate your generous offer, Your Highness, but Damon expects me back in the antechamber to the king's study. He's probably wondering where I am already." "Nonsense, young lady. You'll be much better off nearby, where I can ensure your continued good health. I'm confident whoever Damon is, he'll understand. I can send word so he won't worry." "Thank you, Your Highness, but..." "No, no, it's settled," said Princess Gwynnett. "I've got a very cosy room for you just down the hall. It's quite private."
Merry smiled and nodded. If she was going to be imprisoned, she'd go gracefully, then do her best to escape as soon as possible. She was a wizard, after all, if rather new at the profession.
"Guards!" called the princess.
A man and a woman in sky-blue royal Daron livery, gold-plated armour and tall helms topped with blue feathers, entered and bowed to the princess. The man lumbered, but the woman had the grace of a dancer or a well-trained swordswoman.
"You know where to take her," said Gwynnett.
The guards bowed again and helped Merry to her feet. With a hand on each elbow, they steered her out the door and down the corridor.
"The princess is so kind to give me my own room," said Merry. I thought I'd have to find an inn nearby, but she saved me the expense.
The guards didn't react, even though Mary added a thick layer of sarcasm to her tone, like mortar between stones in a castle's curtain wall. After more steps than expected, Mary was standing in front of a door more appropriate for a treasure room than guest accommodations. It was banded with iron-reinforcing stripes and looked like it would take hours for an axe to chop through. The door had a small viewing panel protected by vertical iron bars and a hinged section at the bottom that opened from the outside. "For delivering the prisoner's meals," thought Mary. The man took a key from his belt and opened the door. Mary tried to examine its details so she could fashion a duplicate from solidified sound, but the man blocked her gaze with his body. The door swung wide, its hinges making a terrible squeak. "It makes sense not to oil cell doors," thought Mary, distracting herself from her current situation. "I'd better get away now before I'm inside." She called on her mage stone's power and sent four blasts of tight light against the back of the lumbering guard's head. The man fell forward onto the cell's hard stone floor and moaned. He wouldn't be getting up soon. Mary turned to deal with the other guard when she saw the woman had removed her helmet. It was Nyssia, Griffith's fiancée, the woman from Brendinas she and Einan had met on their first day down the river.
"It's a pleasure to see you again," said Nyssia, tossing her long blonde braid. "The pleasure is all mine," said Mary. "Under present circumstances, I'm sure that it is," said Nyssia. "I hadn't realized you were a wizard. Nice work dealing with my colleague before I had to. He's not one of my favorite people. Neither is Princess Gwynedd."
Mary smiled and gave a small bow. "Good to know we're on the same side." Nyssia looked left and right down the hall.
"We are, if you support Queen Caris," she said. "Now, we've got to get you out of the palace. Follow me."
Chapter 22. Daemon.
"Where's the girl who is with me?"
Daemon asked a stocky young man in royal guards livery.
"I told her to wait."
Griffith, the stocky young man, was standing inside the antechamber to the king's study, along with several other men and women in armour. Unlike his fellow guardsmen, Griffith was smiling.
"Mary was never very good at following orders."
"You know her?" asked Daemon.
"We're childhood friends," said Griffith.
"Huh," said Daemon. "Where did she go?"
"Astri came to take her to the queen," Griffith replied.
"Who is Astri?"
"The old queen's personal wizard, of course."
"Caris has a personal wizard now, does she?"
said Daemon, mostly to himself.
"One of the older guards told me she's been serving the queen for decades."
"Really?"
Daemon rubbed his chin.
"Decades," he said softly.
The old wizard studied Griffith for a few seconds, taking in the young man's stocky form and heavy broadsword.
"I didn't know," said Daemon in a more conversational tone. "I've been away from court for a long time."
"I just got here," said Griffith. "This is my first assignment."
"I see, young man.
Griffith."
"Yes, Guardsman Griffith. I'm going to borrow you."
"I can't leave my post," said Griffith.
"I'll take care of that," said Daemon.
He returned to the door leading to the king's study and pounded on it. The other guardsmen in the antechamber saw Daemon's wizard robes and wisely decided to do nothing.
"Dario," he shouted, "I need one of your guardsmen for a few hours."
The king opened the door and stuck his head out.
"This one," said Dario.
"Griffith, isn't it? Do what Daemon asks you until I tell you otherwise."
"Yes, your majesty," said Griffith, bowing.
"You don't have to do that when you're on duty," said the king.
"Sorry, sire."
"Don't worry. You'll get the hang of it after a few more weeks," said Dario.
The king stepped into the antechamber and turned to Daemon. "See that you return him in one piece."
"I'll try my best, but no guarantees," said Daemon, smiling.
"Consider it a royal command."
"I said I'd try," said Daemon. "You'd better do more than try, old man. It's important you succeed."
Daemon nodded to Dario. Griffith shifted his weight from foot to foot, sensing that the young king and the old wizard weren't really talking about his health.
"You there, Hendin,"
said the king to an older guard.
"Zaya?"
"Find that young lady in the wine-coloured dress, the good Sharmat player, and send her in," said the king. "We have unfinished business."
Dario winked at the older guard.
"Then see that we're not disturbed."
Yes, Your Majesty.
Dario smiled at Hendin and returned to his study. The door closed gently behind him.
Find Jennet and tell her the king wants to see her immediately, said Hendin to a young woman in his squad.
The woman left the room with the soft chiming of jangling mail trailing behind her.
Are the queen's rooms still in the south wing?
Asked Daemon.
They're in the west wing now, your wizardness, ever since King Dario took the throne, said Griffith.
Hendin winced.
Call him good wizard lad, unless he has a title.
Sorry, said Griffith, trying to apologize to Hendin and Daemon simultaneously.
I've got a title, but it hasn't had much use in decades, said Daemon.
He opened the door to the corridor.
Lead on, Griffith. That's what I borrowed you for, after all.
Someone was tapping on the door to the Queen's sitting room.
What is it?
Asked Queen Caris. She was doing a piece of intricate embroidery while discussing matters of state, mostly Princess Gwynnett's latest plotting with Astri. The other woman was weaving thin rods of tight light into colourful patterns. Her dark blue hood and robes were on the arm of her chair.
A wizard and a guardsman are at the door with urgent business,
came a servant's muffled words through the thick door to the sitting room's antechamber. Astri was surprised.
Furchus returned from Nova Eberacum already.
Tell the queen I'm back, but still haven't found her daughter, came a loud male voice from the other side of the door.
It's Daemon, said Caris.
Her embroidery fell to her lap, and her heart nearly skipped a beat.
You have to...
Astri was already moving. Her tight light pattern had exploded into a full spectrum of coloured sparks before disappearing. She'd picked up her robes and hood and was running to a dark blue curtained alcove on the far side of the room where servants could wait until the queen required them. It had its own door to an outside hallway.
You can't enter the queen's presence without being announced,
came a protesting servant's voice from the antechamber. Daemon opened the door and stepped into the sitting room with Griffith behind him.
The years have treated you well, Caris.
You always did know how to give a lady a compliment and make an entrance, said the queen, steepling her fingers in her lap.
Daemon strode purposefully across the room and sat in the same chair Merry had occupied earlier. Gruffid stood behind Daemon, trying his best to become part of the furniture.
Have a seat, said the queen. Make yourself comfortable.
Thank you, I will, said Daemon,
settling himself deeper into the padded upholstery. Gruffid, his face impassive, felt like he was watching the first crossing of blades in a fencing match.
I'm looking for a girl, said the old wizard.
Weren't you supposed to be doing that more than 40 years ago, when my daughter disappeared?
Daemon nodded. The queen had scored the first touch.
I suppose I deserve that, he said.
This time the queen nodded.
I'm looking for a younger girl this time. She's only 15. The guard said your personal wizard came to fetch her.
What makes you think you'll be any more successful finding Merry of Applegarth than you were finding Princess Seren of Darren?
Daemon saw an opening and took it.
So she was here.
Yes, said Caris, just like Princess Seren was in the palace for 18 years.
Stop trying to confuse me with ancient history, said Daemon, and before you can say it, I know I'm easily confused.
Queen and wizard exchanged smiles.
Merry was here and talked to us, talked to me, I mean, for almost an hour, said the queen.
Us? Asked Daemon. You and your personal wizard, you mean? Who did you rope into that job?
Her name is Astri, Caris answered. She came to court long after you left.
Decades ago, I hear.
About that long, said the queen.
I'd like to meet her, said Daemon. I'm sure we'd have a lot to talk about.
No doubt, said Caris. I'll let her know when she returns.
Off on one of your errands, then.
Daemon crossed his legs and sat farther back in his chair.
Did you go to Ryas, Nova Eberacum, Bjarniston, or perhaps the southern clan lands?
Queen Caris laughed.
I sent her to the Conclave's library to do some research.
Gruffid didn't understand all the levels of their conversation, but he could tell the queen was ahead on touches, though neither one had yet drawn first blood.
Researching what?
Freezing spells, if you must know.
Damon's face lit up with a grin. Gruffydd could see it reflected in the window panes behind the Queen and in the Queen's amused reaction.
You have a devious mind, Your Majesty.
Thank you, said Karis. You didn't think you were our only hope of stopping the Bifolanders, did you?
I knew you always think 8 moves ahead, said Damon. You're the one who taught Seren Sharmat, after all.
And she was an excellent player, said the Queen, before she disappeared.
Before she disappeared. Aye, said Damon. This Astri must be a powerful wizard.
She's skilled.
Strong enough to freeze the Brenhaven? Asked Damon.
Perhaps, if it comes to that.
If Astri is that strong, the two of us should work together to make it happen.
Now that I know you've agreed to help, I'll suggest that to her.
Good, said Damon.
Fine, said Karis.
Gruffydd was confused. It seemed like the match was over. What about Merry?
What happened to the girl? Asked Damon.
Tight muscles in Gruffydd's neck relaxed.
Derry's daughter? Asked the Queen.
She left with Princess Gwynnett nearly an hour ago.
Why didn't you stop her? Asked Damon.
Merry or the Princess?
Either, said Damon. Both.
She's a resourceful young woman, said the Queen. I thought she might learn something.
Or Princess Gwynnett might, said Damon, shaking his head.
The wizard looked up and over his shoulder at Gruffydd.
Do you know the way to the spider's lair?
I could take you to Princess Gwynnett's apartments, said Gruffydd, after he loosened his jaw.
His teeth had been clenched ever since he'd heard who Merry had left with.
Let's get moving, said Damon,
as he rose and started to follow Gruffydd to the door.
It's been a pleasure chatting with you, Your Majesty.
It certainly has, Master Mage, said the Queen. We'll have to do it more often.
Chapter 23 Fircher. Fircher flew into an open upper window in her townhouse in Brendinas. Her bedchamber was much the way she'd left it. She tossed her flying disc on the bed and traded her blue wizard's robes for green ones before reclaiming her disc and strapping it to her back. A thin sleeve of yellow beryl turned her new blue magestone green, completing her transformation. She rolled up a tapestry of a mage and a unicorn to the left of the fireplace across from her bed and tied it in place with leather thongs. A fresco of a faux stone archway framing an emerald green landscape was revealed. Fircher knew a second fresco remained hidden behind a similar tapestry on the right, but the left side was where her heart was. She stood in front of the fresco. With a word and a gesture, the gate opened, and Fircher stepped through into the highest room in a tower, anchoring one corner of the royal palace in Rias. A dark-haired, powerfully built man in sumptuous green fabric trimmed with white fur sat on a straight-backed chair beside a wide bed. He was a few years older than Fircher, and had an air of command about him, as if he was used to his word being obeyed.
"Your Majesty," said Fircher.
King Tuathal of Tamlok tilted his head and regarded her for a few moments.
"You were expecting to find my brother," he said.
"I was expecting to find an empty bedchamber."
"And instead you found me," said the king. "Vero's out seeing to various preparations for the upcoming battle. I like to sit in his rooms from time to time. It helps me feel close to him when he's away."
"How touching," said Fircher. "Brotherly love. I'm glad you were waiting for me. You're the real decision-maker."
"That's the burden of being a first child," said Tuathal.
He gestured to another chair at a nearby writing table. Fircher sat.
"It's a shame, really," said the king. "Vero would have been a better ruler, but he was second in line and took himself out of the succession by becoming a wizard."
"You've done well as king," said Fircher, "except for restarting the war with Darren."
"Except for that," said Tuathal,
a corner of his mouth turning up.
"I take pleasure in knowing that this will be the last war between our kingdoms."
"Oh?
After this conflict, Tamlok and Daran will be one realm, under one king.
And that king would be you?
Perhaps. Perhaps not, said Tuathul.